Hi, this is Brother Peter Diamond here of MostHolyFamilyMonastery.com, VaticanCatholic.com, and I was going to be talking about the popes against Islam. We have some very interesting new quotes to consider, which show what the Catholic Church actually thinks of the false religion of Islam, and these quotes are particularly relevant because we constantly see the Vatican II anti-popes making statements in reference to Muslims and the religion of Islam that totally reject what the Catholic Church actually teaches on that issue. One of these quotes I will be discussing has a lot of significance to a number of points and one dogmatic definition in particular. In this talk, I will also be refuting a popular objection that defenders of the Vatican II Church make with reference to a major false teaching and heresy in Vatican II. Now, we've pointed out that one of Vatican II's main heresies is that the Muslims, along with us, worship the one merciful God who will judge mankind on the last day. That's taught in Vatican II in Lumen Gentium number 16. That is heresy, of course, because the Muslims reject the Trinity, they reject Jesus Christ. They do not worship the same God as Catholics. Their God is not the true God. Furthermore, this quote in Lumen Gentium says that they worship the God who will judge mankind on the last day. That is particularly heretical and blasphemous because it's a dogma that Jesus Christ will come again to judge the living and the dead. So we see right there a specific denial of Jesus Christ, the true God. Now, in response to this, many defenders of the Vatican II sect will attempt to bring up a quote from Pope Gregory VII. They quote this letter that Pope St. Gregory VII wrote to a Muslim king of Mauritania in around the year 1076. They claim that this letter also indicates that the Muslims and the Catholics together worship the same God. And I'm going to be quoting some of this and responding to it and showing why this argument doesn't hold up. Now, first of all, with reference to this letter, which can be found in Ming Latin Fathers, volume 148, that this was a letter of Pope St. Gregory VII to a Muslim ruler named Al-Nasir, who ruled in what is present-day Algeria. And this Muslim ruler was not your typical Muslim ruler of that period. Obviously, the Muslim rulers were typically very anti-Christian, and the Catholic leaders were frequently at war with them. Now, this Muslim ruler, although he was not a Catholic, he had requested priests for the Christian people in his territory. So this is very unusual for a Muslim ruler. He was actually wanting and desiring to accommodate the Christians in his area by having more priests available for them. So that explains some of the tone of this letter. I think that Pope St. Gregory VII was attempting to be as conciliatory as possible, not only because this Muslim ruler was showing more natural charity toward the Catholics slash Christians in his area, but also he was trying to hopefully open up his heart to conversion. And lest anyone think that Pope St. Gregory VII did not believe in the dogma that all non-Catholics are not saved who die as non-Catholics, and that all who die as Muslims are lost, there was a book written called Pope Gregory VII by Herbert Edward Cowdery, and on page 494, this is a liberal author, he says, quote, "Gregory's statement in 1084 that the Saracens' religion is of no avail for salvation," end quote. So he makes reference to another statement that Pope St. Gregory VII made with reference to the Muslims of that period, in which he made it very clear that the Muslims cannot be saved. Now, in this letter, Pope St. Gregory VII says this, quote, "We and you must show in a special way to the other nations an example of this charity, for we believe and confess one God, although in different ways." So the defenders of the Vatican II apostasy, and the documents of Vatican II claim that, see, we have a pre-Vatican II pope teaching that the Muslims worship the one true God. No, the argument doesn't hold up, because if you look carefully at what he says, Gregory says that both of us believe and confess, or believe and profess. Okay, one could translate that. Yes, they do claim to believe and confess one God. They're not polytheistic. But he didn't say that they believe and confess the true God, or that they believe and along with us worship the one true God. He's saying they believe one God. That's a true statement. Furthermore, in attempting to compare this letter to the heretical teaching in Lumen Gentium, there's a fundamental flaw, because a letter is vastly different from a doctrinal statement, a supposed dogmatic constitution on the Church, which Lumen Gentium purported to be. So something could be stated in a letter by a pope which wouldn't necessarily have the precision or the care that would be put into composing a dogmatic pronouncement, obviously, or an official magisterial statement, or the statement of an ecumenical council. And so he's saying this in the context of trying to be friendly to this Muslim ruler who was a lot more charitable on the natural level, not quite as of bad will as many of the other anti-Catholic Muslims, and trying to open up his heart and also make the situation for the Christians in his area a lot more acceptable. And so he's going to put it in the softest terms possible, and he's saying that they do confess one God. That's a fact. They claim to believe in one God. Whereas with Vatican II, this is an official statement of their beliefs, and they're stating something different, and they're carefully thinking about this and saying that Muslims and Catholics together worship the one true God, mankind's judge on the last day. And that is simply not tenable. And so this statement from Pope St. Gregory VII does not provide proof that Vatican II's teaching is not heretical. It is not a justification for their teaching. It is simply a false argument. And what further confirms this are the quotes I will be covering, and one quote in particular concerning the Muslims. Before I get to those, I will reiterate that if Vatican II's teaching on the Muslims supposedly worshiping the one true God were true, then it would mean that any group which claims to worship one God, even though it rejects the Trinity, would worship the true God. And that, of course, is ridiculous. For instance, you could have a group of occultists or Satanists who say that Lucifer is their God, and they're one God. And according to that logic, one would have to admit that they worship the one true God, because they worship one God. But that, of course, is an evil notion. The same is true for the Muslims who reject the Trinity. Now, in our books, we've quoted some very interesting statements against Islam from the popes. For instance, we quoted Pope Eugene IV at the Council of Basel in 1434, confirming that teaching. Not everything in the Council of Basel was confirmed, but some of the early sessions were confirmed, including this statement. Quote, "There is hope that very many from the abominable sect of Muhammad will be converted to the Catholic faith," end quote. So the teaching of the Church is that Islam is an abominable sect. It's abhorrent to God. Keep that in mind as we continue to see some more of these quotes, and also what the Vatican II antipopes say about Islam. We also quoted Pope Calixtus III, who wrote, quote, "I vow to exalt the true faith and to extirpate the diabolical sect of the reprobate and faithless Muhammad in the East," end quote. So according to Pope Calixtus III, Islam is a diabolical sect. That means that it's a sect of the devil. We also quoted St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologica, who says that if anyone were to worship at the tomb of Muhammad, he would be deemed an apostate, end quote. That's in Part 2, Question 12, Article 1, Objection 2. So obviously there's no respect for this false religion. It's a complete rejection. Now, the history of the church tells us in many sources, when people read the history of the church, Muslims are almost always referred to as infidels, which means unbelievers. But I recently came across a very interesting quote from a pope which shows that Muslims are not only infidels, but they're actually pagans. And this has a twofold significance. It has significance, first of all, because if Muslims are in fact pagans, then it's self-evident that they cannot worship the one true God. It's a devastating blow to those who would defend the teaching of Vatican II that Muslims worship the one true God, for obviously pagans do not worship the one true God. And secondly, it's significant because in Pope Eugene IV's expansive definition on the dogma outside the church there is no salvation, he says that all those who are outside the church, such as pagans and Jews and heretics and schismatics, will depart into everlasting fire, lest before the end of their lives the same have been added to the church. And so some have asked, where are the Muslims in that delineation of the major groups of people who are outside the church above reason? It's, in one sense, not that critical, because the bull goes on to make it clear that no one at all who is outside the church can be saved. But when we show that Muslims are pagans, we can see that they're included in that first group of people, the pagans. So now to the quote on Muslims as pagans. This comes from Dr. Ludwig Pastor, History of the Popes, Volume 2, page 400, and he recounts how, quote, on the feast of St. Peter and Paul, the 29th of June, 1456, he, Pope Calixtus III, addressed a bull to all the patriarchs, archbishops, bishops, and abbots of Christendom, exhorting them by prayers, fasting, and penance to return to the Lord, that he may again return to us, and also to direct their attention to the reformation of flocks committed to their charge. The following special directions were added, quote, on the first Sunday of each month, processions were to be made in every diocese in order to pray that the threatened Turkish invasion might be averted. The Missa Contra Paganos was to be said, and a suitable discourse delivered to the assembled people. Moreover, every priest, without exception, was required to use the following prayer in every Mass he said, quote, Almighty Everlasting God, to whom all power belongs, and in whose hand are the rights of all nations, protect thy Christian people and crush by thy power the pagans who trust in their fierceness. End quote. So Pope Calixtus III commands the Missa Contra Paganos, meaning the Mass against the pagans, with reference to the Turks and the Turkish invasion. That, of course, refers to the Muslims. So the Muslims are pagans. And this, of course, only comes about 15 years after the Council of Florence and Pope Eugene IV and the dogmatic definition that references the pagans. So we can see the sense of the church at that time, the understanding of the church, is that Muslims are included in the group of pagans because they don't worship the true God. They worship a false God. Pagans do not worship the true God. In fact, if you look at the history or etymology of the word is derived from the Latin pagus, from which pagani, those who live in the country, were called. It was a name given to country folk who remained heathen or continued to worship the false gods of the empire, formerly of the empire, after the cities had become Christian. And so the pagani referred to those people who continued to worship false gods, not people who worship the true God. I mean, it should be self-evident that pagans don't worship the true God. And therefore, if according to the teaching of the church, Muslims are pagans, that's the mind of the church, they, of course, do not worship the true God. And so it brings home with even more clarity how heretical and blasphemous is the teaching of Vatican II and the consistent teaching of the Vatican II antipopes, that the Muslims along with us worship the one true God, and so forth. Now there's some other interesting new quotes which I'd like to share which shed further light on what the church teaches about the false religion of Islam. On April 12, 1462, Pope Pius II gave an address on the occasion of the procession of St. Andrew's Head, and he said, quote, "Turn the anger of the Almighty against the godless Turks and barbarians who despise Christ the Lord," end quote. So Pope Pius II is referring to the Turks as godless. And the source on that is Dr. Ludwig Pasteur, History of the Popes, Volume 3, page 260. And then the same Pope, on September 26, 1459, he gave an address in which he said, quote, this is a very interesting quote, "In the royal city of the East, they have slain the successor of Constantine and his people, desecrated the temples of the Lord, defiled the noble church of Justinian with their Mahometan abominations. Each success of the Islamic Sultan will be only a stepping stone to the next until he has mastered all the Western monarchs, overthrown the Christian faith, and imposed the law of his false prophet on the world," end quote. And the source on that is Pasteur, Volume 3, pages 81. And Pius II refers to them as the Mahometan abominations, their actions, their religious worship. How different is that from what we see in the teaching of the Vatican II antipopes and even in the teaching of Vatican II itself? For instance, in Nostra Aetate number 3, in another statement in Vatican II on the Muslims, it says that the Church looks upon Muslims with respect. Then it says again that they worship the one true God, the one God, living and subsistent. And it goes on to say they seek to submit themselves wholeheartedly to him, just as Abraham submitted to God. And it says, hence they have regard for the moral life, and worship God in prayer, almsgiving, and fasting, end quote. And this is a supposed official teaching of the Vatican II Church. And we have a true pope rightly pointing out that they are Mahometan abominations, and that Muhammad was a false prophet. Another interesting quote comes from the same pope on October 13, 1487. He published a bull inviting all the European princes to a congress, and he said that the church had never been so trampled upon as she is now by the adherents of the false prophet Muhammad, the bloodthirsty hosts of the, quote, venomous dragon, end quote. So he calls Islam and its false prophet a venomous dragon. Now, if we compare that with some of the things said by the Vatican II antipopes, for instance, Benedict XVI, in his address December 22, 2006, said, "My visit to Turkey afforded me the opportunity to show also publicly my respect for the Islamic religion, a respect, moreover, which the Second Vatican Council Declaration Nostra Aetate No. 3 pointed out," end quote. So he says not only that he respects the Muslims, but the false religion itself. And he says that this respect for the false religion is taught in Vatican II. And he's saying that he respects a religion which the popes have declared is diabolical, meaning of the devil, abominable, meaning abhorrent to God, godless, and brought to us by a false prophet who is described as a dragon. Benedict XVI, in his general audience September 20th, 2006, again says that, expresses his, quote, deep respect for the great religions, especially the Muslims who worship God. In Truth and Tolerance, 2004, page 204, he talks about Islam, quote, with all the greatness it represents. In his address to representatives of Islam, August 20th, 2005, he says, quote, the believer and all of us as Christians and Muslims are believers. You guide Muslim believers and train them in the Islamic faith. You have a great responsibility for the formation of the younger generation, end quote. Now this is an interesting quote because he refers to Muslims as believers. They're just the opposite. They're infidels, which means unbelievers. That's what they're almost always referred to as, unless they're referred to worse, as pagans, etc. And so they're saying that they do believe, not that they disbelieve. And he's also talking about the Muslims and their responsibility to form people in the Islamic faith. I mean, this is total apostasy. Benedict XVI, in his catechesis, August 24, 2005, speaks of his, quote, esteem for the other great religious traditions, and he says, Islam occupies a special place among them, end quote. So he esteems Islam. In his speech apologizing for his comments on Islam in September of 2006, Benedict XVI spoke of, quote, my personal view of the Quran, for which I have the respect due to the holy book of a great religion. The holy book of a great religion, a religion which the popes say is diabolical, of the devil. And I'm going through some of these quotes because their heresies with regard to Islam, in contrast with the papal teachings against Islam, it provides us with such a stark contrast that you could literally defeat a defender of Vatican II by simply limiting yourself to evidence on this issue. You could refute a defender of the Vatican II anti-popes by simply pointing out these facts about Islam. Benedict XVI, of course, he prayed in a mosque toward Mecca like the Muslims, indicating that he accepts their religion and basically took part in their false religion. That occurred in around December of 2006. In his Angelus address, October 22nd, 2006, he congratulates and greets basically the Muslims of the entire world who are celebrating the Ramadan fast. And so he's basically encouraging them in their false religion. And then, of course, we have all of the statements and actions from anti-Pope John Paul II. He went to the mosque, just like Benedict XVI has. He gave a message to the Grand, quote, Sheikh Mohammed in February of 2000, and he thanked those who are developing Islamic culture, end quote. I thank those who are developing Islamic culture, a culture which is diabolical, according to the Catholic Church. John Paul II, on March 21st, 2000, he asked St. John the Baptist to protect Islam. He said so many times that the Muslims worship God, that we believe in the same God, etc., etc. And so this provides an undeniable example of apostasy and heresy, not only in Vatican II, but in the official teachings of the Vatican II anti-popes. And I just wanted to give a few other quotes from the popes. For instance, we've quoted in our material Pope Clement V at the Council of Vienne, talked about what a disgrace it is that the followers of Islam, the Saracens, quote, in their temples or mosques, meet to adore the infidel, the unbeliever Muhammad. And he's explaining what a disgrace this is that they loudly invoke and extol his name. And he says, this brings disrepute on our faith and gives great scandal to the faithful. And he says, these practices cannot be tolerated without displeasing the divine majesty. We enjoin on Catholic princes one and all, they are to forbid expressly the public invocation of the sacrilegious name of Muhammad, end quote. Now, obviously, that was in a different era in which, you know, the Catholic Church and Catholic princes had the authority to stop that kind of activity, but nevertheless, it shows you what the popes and what the Council of Vienne said and thought about this false religion. And then we have Pope Benedict XIV in his encyclical Quod Provinciale, August 1st, 1754, in which he says that Turkish or Mohammedan names should not be given either to children or adults in baptism. And he's very strong about this, that this is a major problem. If anyone were to give a Turkish or Mohammedan name to his child, any Catholic. And he says, this should not be hard for any of you, for the schismatics, don't do this, and unless your justice abounds more than theirs, you shall not enter the kingdom of God. And so there's no respect for Islam by a Catholic, by the popes, by the church. Total disrespect for this false religion. We, of course, desire the conversion of the Muslims. We want them in charity to know the truth and be baptized and converted, but their religion is evil. The people who are in it are in darkness, and the church condemns it. It doesn't respect it. And so this is one of the clearest, most indefensible heresies of the Vatican II Church, and there's no way around it. And so we should keep those quotes in mind from the popes the next time Benedict XVI makes some statement or commits some action with regard to Islam. And as we've seen, there's no justification in the heresy taught by Vatican II in the letter of Pope St. Gregory VII. It doesn't teach the equivalent of what Vatican II taught. The context is very different. The person he was speaking to has to be taken into account, and it's a letter, not a dogmatic pronouncement.